Hello, hello, my lovelies. Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, Elle Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We're also on the streaming platforms, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and more. If you are listening to us on one of those streaming platforms, give us some stars, give us some feedback, show us some love, or maybe not so much love, but at least give us some feedback so we can get bumped up in the ratings and more people can find out about this podcast, because again, we talk to the movers and shakers and innovators from all aspects of the music industry to find out exactly how they got their music job. We want to know how people get their music careers today. What decisions do they make? How did they start out? How was the seed planted? We got it all right here. So last episode, I had the immense pleasure of speaking with Matthew Mayer. He is an incredibly talented piano artist. He's an award-winning artist. He is also an incredibly busy man. He has his own podcast. He has a blog. He has a website. He has been number one on Billboard. He's got an amazing social media presence. And yet, he also has a full-time business career. So how does he do that? How is he able to sustain and support his successful music career as well as a day job? Well, you can hear all about that and so much more if you just go on back and listen to that last episode. So this week, I have the pleasure of speaking with John McLucas, and he is a hustler, baby. He is a very, very talented musician, songwriter, drummer, and he's going to tell us all about his music career and how he really does take a very specific approach to his music career and to being a successful producer and recording engineer, and now his own solo music career. Just really, really good nuggets. He's going to break it all down for you. Before we do that, let's hear a track from John. That's right. This is a brand new minty fresh track called Sanity. Here we go.
I pour my words. It's everything you can.
Get that music job.
Hey, Elle Ariel. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me your first memory of music. Tell me about the household that you grew up in. What were your parents listening to? All that stuff.
I can't say I had a super musical, or really any kind of musical family. I mean, probably the first song I remember was Holiday by Madonna, oddly enough. And that was what my sister needed in order to fall asleep every single night for a very long time. So... I know that song very, very well. And then I think, I was 10 and my mom decided to start taking guitar lessons because she never had the chance as a kid. So she was like, all right, everybody pick an instrument. You're going to take lessons. You don't have to do it. You know, you have to try it. And then if you hate it after a couple of months, you can stop. So I don't know. I almost chose sax and I'm glad I didn't. I love saxophone, but this was my chance to be loud as I was as a child. And so I had to pick the drums. So two lessons later, my mom bought me a drum set and my father was very upset. He spent big money on a young child. And the first stuff I learned was like AC/DC. That was like the stuff that really got me going, which I think my uncle showed me. So I think not considering Holiday, I think Back in Black was the probably definitive first encounter with music where I was like, yeah, that's a thing I want to do.
That's awesome. So you said you were 11 when you started the drums?
10, but I mean, I was but a lad at the time.
You were but a lad. So did you walk us through that? Because I always like to hear kind of how the seeds were planted. So you're 10, then you're going to go into like junior high and high school. Were drums kind of the main thing that you were doing, or?
Yeah, I didn't pick up another instrument until I was 18. So the first 8 years were all drums. Mm-hmm. And within that, I think around first, second year of high school is when I started playing in bands. It was more just like, you know, I picked badminton because it was the easiest sport where you had to have the least athletic ability in my mind. So I picked that, and then I was talking to somebody who's like, I play bass. And I'm like, oh, I play drums. And then, you know, that's how bands are made when you're 14, 15.
Right.
So then kind of from there, that band played one show, three songs. We crushed it, and then it fell apart. And then I made a new band, and that one we played like 10 shows, which, you know, so I thought we were about to blow up. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, I think I'd realized I was separating from the pack as far as my ambition and hunger compared to other people. Mm-hmm. And that was just kind of becoming a divide. And I'll say I was not the greatest band leader. Believe it or not, a 16-year-old trying to lead a group of four or five kids may not be the best at it.
When you say you were doing shows, where was this? Like, where were the shows?
There's a few local clubs, you know, so I grew up about 30 minutes south of San Francisco. So we were about 30 to 45 minutes away from two major cities in the Bay Area, which meant we always had to go far for our shows. So I said, screw this. I hate this because, you know, again, when you're a kid, getting your 17, 16, 18-year-old friends to go all the way up to San Francisco is unlikely. So there's a pizza place around the probably four blocks from my house, and they had a spare room that hardly ever got used. So I just asked the owners one day if we could throw shows in there.
Nice.
Because I was like, hey, you're going to make more money, and we don't need to get paid. We just need a place to make noise. We'll bring our friends, they'll eat your pizza, and you'll have a great Tuesday. So that was like my first business deal. And yeah, so we just started throwing shows in this very unflattering pizza shop, but it was a place to play. And it was the only place really in my city besides like classy wine places where you have to wear ties. So it's great.
Well, and the thing is like that to me also shows like the hunger you were talking about, because not everybody has that kind of mindset of like, where's a space that we could play? It's more like, oh yeah, I'm just going to jam with my friends. But clearly you were kind of thinking ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always trying to be intuitive with how I approach stuff. I mean, we did the same thing for our EP release. It was just, you know, it's frustrating to try to coordinate it between the venue and the timeline you want to do. So we just, again, said, screw it. I got a permit from the city to block off our street block, and I called it a block party, but it was really just a show. Mm-hmm. And I flyered the neighborhood to let everybody know twice, just so it's like, if you have an issue, like I'll send you to the movies, like just so you don't have to listen to it. And we just, yeah, blocked off the street, brought a porta potty in so people didn't go in the house. And we had almost 70 people just sitting in our road, watching us, you know, watching the bands play. So I've always tried to be super intuitive with coming up with something to make it happen.
Right. That's really cool. So what about, you know, after high school, did you go to a music school or major in music, or what happened next?
Yeah. So after that, I took not a gap year, but I took a year at a community college because I didn't quite know what to do. Mm-hmm. As most humans at that age, to really think you know is rare. So I took that year, dabbled in a few new instruments and a few new paths. And with the naiveness of my age, and I think the anecdotes I've heard from other people, it's, you know, of course, don't go pursue music directly, but if you go to, you know, work in a studio, that's the way to make the money. You know, that's not like that's oversaturated or anything. That's easy. I mean, I enjoyed it. I was that kid who had the first one kind of in the circle to get crappy recording gear. So mm-hmm. I was having people over to my house already in the living room, like playing and recording them and shouting between the rooms because I didn't know what a talkback mic was. So we would just shout at each other, and that was how we'd communicate. And it was all very innocent, but kind of at that point, I was like, okay, maybe this audio thing is good. So I went to Musicians Institute down in Hollywood, and I did their audio program, which is I did 9 months of it. And, you know, I came in with some previous knowledge, but learned more there. And it was really more about, I think, having like a network of kids that are all musicians and getting super immersed in that. And I also got to take drum classes as well to keep kind of fostering that side of myself.
How did you learn before? Like, were you just like looking at YouTube videos, or how did you kind of teach yourself the basics before?
Oh yeah, I totally forgot about that. So when I was a junior in high school, so I'll say this, where I grew up, there's a lot of very wealthy families that live like just on the other side of where my high school was from the side I was on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is where, you know, all the home, you can't even see the homes because there's just like trees and walls and the driveways are like football fields. And a lot of those families' kids went to my high school. So they had a lot of wealthy, insane wealthy people donating money. So we were fortunate enough to have an audio class that started when I became a junior. So of course I signed up for that. And that's actually where I met the band that we did all that, you know, playing in pizza shops and driveways in. So that was like the gateway drug to everything because, you know, the teacher, shout out to Mr. Diesel, great guy. I definitely didn't feel the hands-on instruction because I was told to turn the knobs until it sounded good. So, but you know what? It was enough because you spend 4 hours a week turning knobs and experimenting with recorded music between that and YouTube. That's really enough to see if you like it.
Yeah.
So that's where I got the footing. And then it was, oh, okay, these other bands, nobody knew how to record. We're all kids. So I did just horrific trash recordings. And that was kind of the start. And then I thought, all right, I think I can do this more.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. Yeah. I mean, I love that. Like turn the knobs until it sounds good. That's like sage wisdom. If you ask one of those old school, like venerated recording engineers, that's essentially what they tell you.
Yeah. That's something I don't at all understate the value of that. But I think for kids who are just starting out, when like, you have no idea what a compressor is, it would have been great. Because I watched like one YouTube video and I was like, okay, cool. I understand compression. Like mm-hmm. easy, no problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it's like 8 years later and I still like am barely feeling like I comprehend truly the characteristics of the compressors I use. But I do agree now, like I don't really know the moves. I can't tell you the moves that I do. I just kind of move with the tools at this point. And now I just turn the knobs and understand how things are feeling and my ears have developed. So now it's true. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I just turn the knobs until I'm like, yeah, this sounds like they wanted it. And then send it off.
Yeah, I think that it can be very intimidating. So I actually appreciate that advice because you can go into like the rabbit hole of like the super technical aspects of recording and mixing and mastering. And it can be, sometimes I should say for myself, it's like you feel like you're in a physics class or something. But just getting back to that basic, no, seriously, this is a very complicated way of saying turn the knobs until it sounds good. And you might not understand the why of it right now, but you're ultimately going to get to the same destination. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think a lot of times people can, between that and presets, kind of, you can get things that are at least listenable mm-hmm. with all the technology that's out there today.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no excuse now to not at least being able to like throw in a couple of presets between some compression EQ and some reverbs and put a thing together at least.
Yeah. Yeah,
so agreed, I encourage agreed. People to do that all the time.
Yeah, that's awesome. So why did you decide Musicians Institute?
Got to be in Hollywood. You know, that's where it all is. But I mean, that actually was my reasoning. So I moved to LA, I think, because a lot of people say that's where you need to be. And I don't at all agree with that anymore. But it was definitely, I think that's where I needed to be at the time. And as well, I just wanted to be away from home. I adore my family deeply, but there's so much growth that happens when you're in the flames. Mm-hmm. So just getting pushed out to somewhere new. I mean, every adult over, you know, 35 just immediately thinks music, LA, you know, country, Nashville, like you can't, you know, right. Theater, New York, like you can't do any of those things anywhere else. So mm-hmm. no, that's kind of what I believed as well. But I also can't hate because it worked. So it worked. What can I say?
So tell us about that. You were there, you said you were there for 9 months.
Yeah. So I did, they have a very short program. It's only a 6 month, like little certificate program. I did there an extra month of their audio stuff. And then I actually took a couple of part-time quarters doing drums just to tighten up my chops because I'd gone through their kind of program to get put on the roster list for when an audition comes through for a tour or for a backing band. So I was getting my chops in, went through that process, and then I landed a gig producing an album in New York that was a little over 2 weeks between travel and needing to sleep. So that started right at the beginning of the next 10-week quarter. So I was like, well, I guess I'm not going to sign up again. And I hope that I just am too busy to need to go back to school. That was kind of my initial, like my initial landmark that I wanted to have. So that's kind of, that's what pulled me out of the program. And I can safely say I will not have to return to school now, which is good.
Nice. So what were you thinking at that time? Were you like, I'm going to become, like, in terms of your drumming and then the producing, did you feel like I'm going to join a big time band, or like, tell us kind of your mindset at that time?
Ooh, okay. So I'm trying to think which groups I've, as every human in LA, you bounce around between a lot of groups over the years. So I think at that time I was playing in two groups. And during that time, I don't really think I had a specific vision, and I honestly barely do now. I've got a couple of things that work, so I understand, you know, what's recurring, and I think what I want to keep as part of where I take my life and my career. But I mean, there's so much that is still possible. So I think at the time, I was more just some cross between drumming and producing, and you know, and doing the engineering, creative side of things. I didn't really have a specific vision, honestly. I was just, you know, you're hungry for any opportunity you can get and seizing it. So that's kind of honestly.
So was this sort of like whatever came down the pike? You were like, okay, let me try this.
Yep, nice and easy.
Okay, so you do this 2-week producing project in New York, and then what happens?
So I did that, and then in the midst of, well, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure how legally binding the ghetto contract I had to sign when I left this band is, but for the sake of not ever getting in trouble, not like I think they're watching, but an undisclosed band, I'll call them that. So I got hit up by an undisclosed band at the time because I did an audition and I barely didn't get it. They did this follow-up thing. It's like, hey, it's between you and somebody else. And then they picked the other person. And then I got re-hit up by them when I was in New York. And they had kind of gotten left at the lurch by the other person.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, okay, great. Cause they were looking for just a hired gun to tour with. And I'd never been on tour. So, and this was something I got through MI. This was an audition, you know, where they send an email and they're like, hey, this band's looking for this kind of stuff. And you match that, learn these two songs and email me back and pick a slot and you'll audition. So I did that, you know, and then they re-hit me up again. So I joined them pretty much when I got back and left the other groups because, you know, I knew I was going to be on the road and it's a lot more demanding and we had a lot of cool things going on. And so that was almost 2 years, was trying to balance being in that band with trying to keep a living together. So at this point, you know, I didn't have any support. So I'm trying to scrounge my bills payment and slowly eating through my savings to keep this balance between this band trying to engineer plus survival.
Were you touring? Were you touring with them?
Yeah. So we actually toured quite a bit. I mean, it was, you know, they definitely took a risk taking me on because I wasn't road tested, but you know, they took that risk and I, you know, definitely proved my worth. And we toured 15, 18 states, at least with my time with them. And we did some pretty rad shows, a lot of really difficult situations with getting signed to this label that ended up being a very poor situation and having our album release get messed up with this month-long tour. We had already gotten booked with a big agency. So we had to eat fat shit for about a month because the tour was supposed to be, you know, having the funding from the album release from the label. And then they pulled out of releasing the album. And then of course we couldn't back out of the tour. So, you know, we had a lot of ups and downs, but, you know, I got to cut my teeth and learn a lot about like what it's like to have a manager, what, you know, booking, learning about working with booking agents, really like touring and how to survive on the cheap. And at the end of it, I actually got to play a massive show opening for Tool, Primus, and Coheed.
Nice.
So that was probably, you know, hands down one of the best days of my life.
Mm-hmm.
But that was about a 2-year period of trying to balance that. And the balance was not going well. And I was, I think the only guy who was truly supporting himself, and people had other sources of income coming in from other people in their life. So that was a big friction point. It was like, I needed to live, trying to live out here. So.
Yeah. Can you, I think that's a really good point. Cause I don't think enough people kind of know about that there is this it just because you go on tour, just because you open for Tool, doesn't mean that it's like all wine and roses. I interviewed one of my previous guests perform with Kendrick Lamar with Absolute, and he was saying, I was broke. I was dead broke after a year. So it was like this huge tour with these incredible big names in hip hop. And it was like, he's like, I went home seriously in debt. You know what I mean? So I think that mm-hmm. a lot of people just don't realize that it's virtually unsustainable. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about that.
Yeah. Oh no, I have plenty to say about that. I mean, and there's definitely a reason why I've put myself into a position where I tour significantly less than I used to. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk tour struggles first. I think at the end of the day, a lot of people, of course, this isn't the Kendrick Lamar thing. I think that's a different situation, which I'll speak to. But I think a lot of bands want to tour because it looks sick and because, you know, it's a great Instagram post. And it looks, as much about the perception, it feels like, as it is about actually touring. Mm-hmm. Because I know the moment I talked about being signed, the moment I was like, yeah, you know, our manager this, and oh, our booking agent got us this show to like my circle, you know, it's like a humble flex. It's very much a humble flex.
I have never heard that word before, believe it or not.
It's like a humble brag, but I feel like humble, but it's not bragging. Like, it's straight up trying to flex on
my humble flex.
My friend.
I've never heard that. That's awesome.
Yeah. You know, I'd like look at my phone and I'd see like something come in from the label, and it might be, you know, not something favorable, but it'd be like, oh, label hit us up. Hold on 1 second. You know, just because it seems super sick. That seems like it's out of a movie. Right. And I think that's what a lot of people are wanting to do with their time, is if they say they're on tour, it definitely, and I can confirm, people looked at me with more respect. Mm-hmm. Like, I would then go back home. Like, I remember after all this stuff happened, I went back home and people were like, dude, you're big time now. Whoa, it's crazy. And, you know, I didn't lie, but I'm also not, you know, talking about all of the problems going on internally. So
I think it's a point, a really good point that you're making, and that I think it's not a case of everything you did is amazing. There's no taking away from that. The problem is that the system is set up that it just literally can't support working artists, working musicians. It's like there's just simply not enough streams of revenue, streams of income coming in that can support. You should be big time. You know, there's no question. Everything you're doing is right. The fact that you're on tour, that is amazing. The problem is that there's no backup. There's no support system that, like you were saying, your bandmates had other people that they could rely on. But if you're like, you know, not the trust fund baby, you've got to figure out something to support this career.
Yeah. No, it's very, very difficult to monetize. And that's why when I've had people ask about like going on tour, and it's like, you're not ready, man. Like, I just couldn't think of a worse way to gain fans for 99% of people that want to go on tour. That is the biggest waste of your time and energy to go. Like, if I think about the collective manpower hours. Hold on. I'm whip out my calculator because I did this once before, but I need to do it again because I think it's a powerful point. Because if you imagine the average amount of people, I guess, that you'd put in a van, let's just say four people, mm-hmm. you know. So if there's four humans and they're gone for a full 7 days, I'm not going to count sleeping because, you know, sleeping happens every day. Mm-hmm. So if we say they sleep 8 hours a day, that leaves 16 hours per day of being awake that goes into touring, whether it's just like staring into the nothing as you drive through Wyoming, or loading gear, sitting in loud venues, being sad, watching Netflix. Like, I consider all that stuff is still going into it. All that energy that's spent in the van is opportunity cost that could be spent making money at your, you know, day job or whatever your job is. Mm-hmm. So that's 64 manpower hours per day, you know, times seven, that's 448. So I got 450 hours that is spent to go, let's say in a week, playing five shows is pretty aggressive, especially for a DIY band. So we'll say five. So let's say they played five shows, and if they are really good shows, there might be 80 to 100 people. That would be insane for the locals to pull that off. Mm-hmm. But if they did, you know, an 80 to 100 people at least our band, which we got a lot of great live feedback, you know, people go, oh, that's crazy. So we would maybe retain 5 to 10% of the audience if it was like super lit, but we also didn't have the systems in place to understand how to truly retain somebody and get them into our universe when they would approach us. So in that case, most optimistically, you're getting 30 to 50 people that might be into your band, and like how many of those are going to purchase something. But to get 30 to 50 people to listen to your music through an Instagram ad is definitely going to take, you know, let's say everybody works 46 hours for $10 an hour. That's $460 you can put into an Instagram ad with one collective 46 hours of the band's labor at their day jobs. It's California. Isn't it like 15 at this point? I'm not even sure.
So, yeah.
I think it's like scaling up slowly, but so that's super low version. But then like $460 that you could put into an Instagram ad and run it in $20 increments and keep optimizing and running split tests. That just seems like a far more effective way to use your time and energy than to go slog around sitting in the van for that all that time. It's not good for your health. People eat trash. Your sleep schedule's ruined. And it's very emotionally taxing. And like that's it just... If your point is to gain fans, it's the worst way to gain fans.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I can sit down and make a podcast that's growing every single month in my underwear, like that's how I want to gain a following, is in my underwear. Like I don't have to, you know, I can do it from the comfort of my own stuff. So that's my rant about that. Like the math just makes zero sense, mm-hmm. especially when people are losing. So like, and bands are so bad at making money on tour. We actually did most runs barely, but because we made sacrifices to make that happen. I think if I did it, next run I go on, I want to do like daily podcasting or some kind of, I think a daily podcast would be great, because if I think about the Kendrick Lamar guy, you know, if he had a 10-minute podcast every day talking about his journey on tour and, you know, ran $10 of ads every single day against Kendrick Lamar fans saying like, hey, I'm, you know, playing bass for this guy. You know, you can hear the journey every single day at 9 a.m. here. I think that next time I go on the road, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to, on my same podcast, I'm going to do that. Just because, like, then that's a story and a narrative that'll get people excited. And you're already going after the people that are going to be interested in it because you get to use Kendrick Lamar's name. So I don't know. That's where I'd go with it. But it is a very difficult system to monetize. It is, unfortunately. And there's not really like a sexy solution to it, which is.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's like old paradigm versus new paradigm. It's sort of the old music business model coming up against this new sort of online digital media landscape. And how do you, can you do both? Can you do one or the other? A lot of the, as you know this, a lot of the older bands, right? Like the Eagles, all they do is tour because their legacy, right? That's how they make their money. It's touring and merch because they've been known for 40, 50 years. You know, they've built a legacy. Yeah. The fans will come out and see them. They're used to buying physical product, right? Like merch or CDs. They are faithful as hell. They're going to show up because they're afraid one of you is going to die. So they're going to show up.
No, that's true. That's so true.
You know what I mean? Like, that's why the Stones keep touring, you know? It's like, everybody's like, oh my God, this could be the last show for Keith Richards. Like, we gotta go, you know? But that's the thing. That's a model that is very lucrative for them. But if you're an unknown band just starting out, does it make sense to tour? Is this just literally like throwing money into a fire? So yeah. I think you make a lot of great points.
I think I'm a slave to the free market and to money. And that sounds really bad, but okay. I mean, I'm a slave to money in the sense that like, that's what I'm always looking at before I would jump into something big. If the numbers are there, or if you spend 3 months, you know, if you want to go to, you know, Phoenix, San Francisco, and Vegas, and you spend several months running ad campaigns targeted into those cities at specific fans, you get them opting into emails, you run specific funnels that then, you know, really indulge them in the experience you're creating as an artist. And then you've got 50, 60 people that are, you know, in each city, then it makes sense to go to those cities because then you can email them all individually even and probably get, you know, 20 of them to come out.
Right.
So like that, If I was going to tour again, if I was going to do it on my own stuff, or I wasn't, because I just tour as a hired gun now. I'm not in a band because I'm focusing on producing and nurturing that business, as well as like the podcast and some video content. But, you know, next time I go out on the road, whether it's my own stuff or a band that I might be in the future, like that's how I want to approach it. Because it could fail the two. So I could be talking out my ass and just all that's wrong. So no, theoretically.
I think it's really, really smart. And I think, again, that you have to kind of have that mindset. It's not what it used to be. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to your story. So you basically came, you were like struggling while you were on tour and trying to pay bills and trying to consolidate stuff. What happened when it finished?
Oh, I mean, we did. So I was with them, I think, April 2015. There we go. April 2015 to about February 2017. So a little under 2 years we were together. So we'd gone on several runs. I can't even remember. It's all kind of a blur at this point. But yeah, we'd gone on plenty of runs and done that. And then just as things kind of fell apart with the label, where, for just to keep it vague, they pretty much said, hey, you know that deal we gave you, we're not going to do that. And then a lot of the team just kind of falling apart. And, you know, at that point I'd realized, like, I need to take the bet on myself. Like this, if I'm going to take a risk, you know, I can't, okay, this is how I say it. I forgot how I say it. It's pretty much, I look at it as, if I'm in a startup business, I don't have time for another startup business. Like if I had a day job, I'd have time for one startup, but I can't have the uncertainty of both startups and have no income to rely on.
Right.
You know, I need to go full in on one thing. And between a lot of factors, which I will just very swiftly glaze over and not mention at all, because I don't want to start things. I left and I just said, screw it. I'm just going to figure this out. But I had also chosen to live in South Central in LA because I was like, oh, the band's going to blow up. I'm never going to be home. I'm just going to go live somewhere cheap. So I left that band and all I had was 110 square feet in the hood and had to figure out how to make money recording people in the hood. So it wasn't the easiest thing.
So tell us, like, what happened? How'd you do this? You're back home. You're like, all right, I got to start making money.
Yeah. So, I mean, okay, at the end of the day, like, I just made the best of what I had. And of course I couldn't charge much money because of my location and what I had, but you know, if you imagine a rectangle, then what I did is I would throw my bed up against the wall. This took a little time to develop, but I'm proud of myself because I had my bed. I had everything a normal human has, a bed, a desk. Well, the desk was fine, but then a bed and a dresser and like hamper and blah, blah, blah. So I threw the bed up against the wall and then hung hooks from the ceiling. I went to Joann's and got like dark blue fabric and hooked it all around the sides of the walls so I could cover and kind of drape over the stuff in a way where it didn't look like there was a mattress behind there. So, and of course, it made the room very small because it's already small. But I was able to pull that off. And then what I did is we had an AC box that was just in the living room because there's no AC in the house because it's, you know, these houses aren't cared for. So I would wheel it in the morning when everybody would go to work, set it up in my window so I could work for the day, or if I had a client there, then wheel it back when I was done and reset it back up. So that was kind of my setup at first. It was just me doing that. And, you know, I had connections with people at MI, Musicians Institute. And that was kind of my first circle of clients. And between that and just peppering people on Craigslist, I check it probably every single day to see if there's any possible opportunities. I got a few things through that. And that, I mean, I can't say anything crazy business-wise happened there, but I had enough going to just barely pay my bills, which were super low thanks to living in the hood.
That's smart, yeah. Though. You were hustling. I mean, it was like you're taking the knowledge you had and just trying to, and also staying in music, which is great.
Yeah. I mean, I also didn't have any other skills, so I didn't really have a choice. Like, I guess I could have gotten, you know, a job with like real hours, like a real job. But I kind of figured at the end of the day, I was going to make relatively the same amount of money. And, you know, because I have no talent besides this stuff. So kind of through that, I linked up with another band called Hail Sagan, which is, yes, she was named after Carl Sagan, but it's not like a Carl Sagan like parody band. everybody always thinks that, they're like, oh, it sounds sick. And I'm like, no, it's not about Carl Sagan. But whatever. So at this point, I linked up with them and Nick, the guitarist. They're a duo. So I was just the hired gun drummer. And he's like, yeah, man, I used to live in my rehearsal studio, you know, and just sleep on the floor and do that. So he kind of planted that seed in my head that when this lease was up, I think that's where I need to go. It's just like not have a real home and, you know, kind of be semi-homeless. Mm-hmm. So, you know, after that lease was done, I actually moved everything into the loft of my sister's apartment at the time that she wasn't using. That was my home for like 3.5 months and slept on the floor there. And she gave me a mad deal. I was living in a very nice neighborhood, but of course I got the brother discount, which is fantastic. And then at that point, you know, she understood it was temporary and I found the perfect studio, which I guess I shouldn't name because, you know, I did live there illegally for a year. So I don't want to get the repercussions of that.
Oh, good.
But I did. That was great. And that was, you know, that was not easy because, you know, it's just a rehearsal studio complex. And I guess they're always called rehearsal studios, but there's a lot of producer engineers there because it's a space you can be loud and it's 24-hour. And there's kind of no rules with the noise. So mm-hmm. It's a perfect place to be loud. So there's a lot of studios already there, which is kind of comforting to know. But I knew I was going to very deliberately break the lease mm-hmm. Doing that. So yeah, it was a bit scary going into it. And it's not in the greatest part of the San Fernando Valley. So it's kind of sketchy. And it was honestly a bit kind of scary making that transition. You know, sleeping on the floor. I had a bigger space, you know, 152 square feet, but there were no windows. The only bathroom in the hallway was usually fairly gross. I had to live out of my car, you know, with my clothes because I couldn't mm-hmm. have anything in the studio that wasn't like art, you know, for the studio.
Right.
And I had to, you know, and I didn't tell my clients where I'd live. And I'd often lie and say, oh yeah, you know, I live out in Burbank. I would just say lived with my sister. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I did that for a year. I'd have to shower at the gym. I had no kitchen, eating anything really. You could just eat out of a microwave. And that was actually technically 11 months out of my life. So that was a grind.
You were hustling, man. You were working with what you got. I mean, I admire that. I really admire that. So where did you go from there?
So at that point, I think, actually, a month after I moved into that situation, I went to the Unstoppable Recording Machine Summit, which is an online audio education company, and they threw a small convention over in Orlando. Mm-hmm. So unbeknownst to me at that event, I mean, I met a ton of people, and it was super, super worth it just in general. But then I actually met Stephen Ward, who became my assistant, who replaced my assistant at the time. So I met him in December. And then he started working for me in March because I totally dropped the ball on something. And then I hit him up last minute. I'm like, hey, can you do this task for me the same day and give it to me at 5 p.m.? And he was down. He put himself out there. And yeah, and then he started editing everything for me. So he would do all the tuning, all the cleanup. He would make my sessions how I like them all nice. And that was, you know, a big relief off of my shoulders because this is the time when I'm starting to save money mm-hmm. and have cash built up. So then business started really taking off in 2018 and, you know, it was great because I could finally start stockpiling money. I didn't have to worry about it. Yes, I was living on a floor, but I was finally financially stable and still able to pay Stephen well because I wanted to make sure I could take care of him but still living on the floor because that was like so my priority over, you know, having nice things or having things, honestly, mm-hmm. at all. And then in August, pretty much I'd gotten to the point where things are just really popping off again. Still lived on the floor, but I called Stephen up because he had seen the spot. I'm like, dude, what do I need to pay you to make you move down here? Because I want to start making video content and I want to start doing more things and I need you to do more things, but I need you here to do it. So we negotiated and we got that all sorted out. So, you know, now I pay him every month. He's my first employee. And the first, you know, 6 weeks, because he had to figure out his situation. We were both living on the floor together. And again, you have to think, two men, 152 square feet. There's already a studio in there. Like, you literally couldn't open the door when we would go to sleep. Like you would hit his head. So it's very cozy, but it was also, like, super rad. Just, you know, it was like that total grind, you know, like you and your boy against the world kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, well, you know, because he was getting his stuff sorted out. And then I ended up moving the studio out to the Glendale area. And when I moved in with my girlfriend, because, you know, that was part of that whole discussion when I started dating her was, you know, to keep my overhead low. I couldn't afford to. I mean, it's LA. Like, two rents is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. for now, because again, I'm more concerned about like having Steven taken care of and creating all the content that I want to create to lay that foundation for a lot of good scalable growth down the line. So yeah. And then in September, I had to go look at my girlfriend, make sure. It's been a while. So then in September, I officially left and moved in here and where I'm sitting right now. And I mean, that's, as far as moving, that's kind of the general momentum. But I mean, 2017, 2018 is when things really, really started taking off, because I don't know, like, gosh, I know you're going to ask why, like what I did to make things take off. And that's, so I need to think about the right answer to that.
I'll let you figure it out.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, it's just a slow, like you've had to look back. I mean, it's just a slow, filthy upward spiral. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at its core, it was, you know, it's meeting a person. I think I'm a pretty good hang. I convert really, really well once I get them just sitting down with me and we chat. You know, it doesn't have to be even be about their project. So it was just about going out and meeting people. And then, you know, if we're connecting, I'll always try to follow up on Instagram or Facebook. Like once they add me back or follow me back, I'll DM them and be like, hey, you know, good to meet you, blah, blah, blah. You know, what do you got cooking this year? And just see what they're up to. This is actually a principle I took from taking an online course called the Profitable Producer Course. And it's kind of this workaround way called the needs discovery process. And it's just a very open way of being like, just be interested in what they're doing and then be helpful. So I would ask them like, hey, what's up? Like, what do you, you know, good to meet you. Loved your stuff. What do you got cooking this year? And it's like, oh, we recorded. So now we're, you know, we're getting ready to release in a few months and then we're going to just gig around a bunch. It's like, okay, well, I can't help with that because that's not my wheelhouse, but I can at least point you to a few resources that I think are helpful and that I've heard are helpful from people. So kind of no matter where they were in their journey, I always tried to be valuable. I mean, that whole add value thing that everybody always says, it's true. Mm-hmm. So I can't dispute that. So I would just, anytime I'd go meet somebody, always super consistent on the follow-up, see what they're up to. Okay, cool. And if they say, yeah, I'm demoing some stuff out and probably looking to record soon, I'd say, oh, well, you know, I'd love to toss my name in the hat if it's, you know, if you guys aren't settled on anybody or, you know, or hey, let's get lunch. Like I can show you my setup and we can talk a little bit and see if we're a good fit for each other. So I would never, you know, oversell myself unless I saw that they were, you know, reciprocating back. So I would kind of just like dating a bunch of people for music reasons.
At the end of the day. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I really like is that, again, obviously the hustle, but this idea of building relationships and being really consistent and being top of mind with them, that yeah. It has to be all about them. It has to be, and this has come up before with other guests and I love it. It's this idea of being of service. How can my skill set support your career? And in turn, that's what makes your business successful, right?
Oh yeah. If that's all it's about, that's like especially in service too, you know, it's how can I solve your problems? Mm-hmm. And if your problems is you don't know how to arrange for drums, bass, guitars, pianos, synths, harmonies, and how to create, you know, strong transitions and how to sonically bring it all together. It's like, that's why I've spent the last 14 years slaving away at that. Mm-hmm. So then I can take a demo that's piano and a vocal and create an entire thing out of it, you know, and that's honestly just what it's about, is like, how can I be of service? And if I can't, you know, there's still an immense value in like a phone call I had a couple of days ago. This guy landed a meeting with somebody who might want to manage them. And of course they want to come prepared and they're like, how do I make a business plan? So I straight up just Googled on the phone, how to make a business plan for an artist, for a solo artist. And then looked at like three links. I'm like, okay, you know, I think this is a pretty good link. Just looking it over, you know, I'd recommend you look at this one and, you know, omit the stuff that's unnecessary for you. And then he was just eternally grateful. He's like, oh, thanks, John. You know, just so overwhelmed and kind of scared about doing this. You know, so even though I haven't, it's not given me any money, I've earned brownie points and I've earned respect and gratitude and appreciation, which could or could not come back to me. Well, he's coming to do his EP starting next week. So it is, you know, we obviously work together, but, you know, it curries more favor and then keeps me top of mind. So if somebody says, hey, like, who, you know, who do I go to for this? It's like, oh, John always got your back. Like, even if he doesn't know, I want to be that, like that guy. I want to be able to connect the dots for them.
Right. Yeah, that's such a great point. And I think, too, and now you also know how to make a business plan for a solo artist. You know, like you'll retain that knowledge yourself that you can, again, utilize maybe in your business. You might even decide, hey, you know what? I could have a whole separate arm of my business that's going to be about how to get a booking agent, how to get a manager. What questions should you ask if you're scouting a new manager? You know what I mean? Like, it's like the possibilities are endless. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, actually, that speaks to kind of exactly where I want to take things in the next 5 to 10 years would be to create a machine. Are you familiar with Gary Vaynerchuk?
Yes.
So you know how he describes VaynerMedia as the machine where you like put in an old brand and, you know, modernize them and totally like rework it and make it profitable and make it so much bigger and blow it up?
Mm-hmm. You should probably, actually, I'm thinking my listeners, you should probably tell them.
Okay. So yeah, that makes total sense. So Gary Vaynerchuk is a dude who's always on the internet, but as well, he's just look him up. And so he has VaynerMedia, which is I believe it's like a marketing agency, if I recall correctly. Pretty much what they do is they work with rebranding and advertising for large companies and large businesses. And they're kind of well known for modernizing the marketing strategies and plans for a lot of older school people. And kind of what he wants to do one day is then eventually buy brands that are outdated, like Cracker Jacks, and then run it through the VaynerMedia machine and pop out, you know, a very modern, hip, relevant brand, Cracker Jacks. And so that's kind of eventually what I'd like to build with myself, and just with whatever I decide to call it, would be to be able to have an artist come in. You know, we'd create a package for them and say, yeah, so you're going to spend an hour with this person. You're going to spend an hour with this person. Then you're going to spend an hour over here. Then you spend 2 hours with me. Then you're going to go over here. And we have every like facet of it taken care of. So at the end of I don't know the specifics, but you'd go to all these sections and all these things and walk out with a completely new product. And somebody, you know, and then somebody who would walk you through like the next 12 to 18 months of development with you. So that's a long, long ways away. And that's why I said 5 to 10 years. But I mean, everything, even down to the podcast, is part of that final vision, because it all feeds kind of into the same funnel of knowledge and being valuable. And I don't know, I'm so far away from it. I can't honestly say how it'll end up, but something like that.
I think it's great. And I think, you know, it's sort of, now's the good time to start thinking about it, but not even executing it yet, because in my opinion, like the landscape is still changing so rapidly that a system that you'd come out with could be like obsolete in 6 months. So it's almost like keep planning with an eye on the horizon and just seeing how things kind of continue to shake out. And go from there. The final thing I just want to ask you about is, you mentioned content, and I think that that's so huge. And just talk briefly about how you consistently are putting out content about what you're doing, your brand, et cetera.
Yeah, sure. So I have a few different things that I do, and I'll keep it brief. And I'm sorry for keeping you long, but I think I just have a lot of repressed anger from touring, maybe. And So I have a few different avenues. The first one that's taken off really well is called the Stay Spongy Show, which is a podcast where we learn and absorb as much as we can to help our music business and career. And yes, that is the tagline from it. That's why it went super weird. But that is all just either stuff that I'm distilling down from things I've learned personally, or distilling down lessons from other people in our conversations, trying to take away the things that they've done through their success and passing it on and trying to make it as palatable as possible and as concise as I can, which doesn't always happen, but I do my best. And that kind of, it's slightly audio engineer focused, but again, it's more feeding into just the concepts behind things which apply to artists. I mean, it's all the same for being an audio engineer, photographer, videographer. Those fields are so insanely the same in the premises of how things are done, besides a couple tiny specifics. So that's one facet that I want to do. Cause again, I'm going Gary Vaynerchuk in the sense of like audio, video, written word. So that's my audio facet. I have a YouTube channel that I started a few months ago once I got on the swing with my assistant. And that is one video a week of me showing my producing skills. So it's me working on somebody's song for an hour and having that cut down. Or I don't know what it's going to, I think it's going to drop on Tuesday. I remixed this guy's ambient song and turned it into like a hip hop beat and then sang about Rick and Morty over it.
Nice.
So I'm really excited about that. And so it's more of a remix. So depending on how people respond, that might be more the gist. But there's that aspect as well, because I want people to like watch me. Like, you can literally watch me produce and like watch how I am in the studio and my goofy likeness. And that kind of gives you a really good idea of how I act with an artist next to me. So that's kind of an extension. And then lastly, I do a weekly, my favorite new music segment of stuff that's come out recently. So it's encouraged to help me find new music. And then just Facebook and Instagram. I'm always trying to just talk about what's going on in my life, going on in my day, filming just 15 seconds of what I'm mixing that day, throwing it up so people know that I'm busy, and it keeps me top of mind.
Yep, I think that's brilliant. So can you give me your, or give us your IG handle, your Facebook, the business, that type of thing?
All the pages. All right, yeah. For sure. All right. Let's go. So Instagram is John_McLucas. That is JOHN_MC Lucas. And my Facebook page is facebook.com/JHN McLucas. Brand inconsistency, but you know, oh well. And you can go to johnmclucas.com. That has everything from a page about the production mixing work I do to a link to the podcast to my solo music, which starts coming out February 22nd. And that's going to be an interesting new venture. And that's just honestly, that's its whole different universe. But that's all that. And if you do want to get in touch about production or mixing, johnmclucas.com is the place to do that. There's a contact, very simple contact form. Or if you are a person of the young generation, you're probably just going to DM me on Instagram, which is totally fine. I have accepted that Instagram DM is where business happens now. Mm-hmm. It seems to keep being that way. So yeah. You can DM me or hit me up through my contact form. And those are the places. And lastly, the podcast Stay Spongy Show is everywhere that you'd find your podcasts, or stayspongyshow.com. And my YouTube's under my name. So just look up myself and you'll see that sexy mug. You know you're in the right place.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much, John. I so appreciate having you on the show.
Well, thank you, El Ariel. I appreciate it as well. It's great to meet you, too.
So great to meet you, John. So, again, you can find John online, ubiquitously online, at johnmclucas.com or John_McLucas on the IG. And again, don't forget to subscribe to his amazing podcast, stayspongy.com. Sorry, Stay Spongy Show. I'm saying .com. Stay Spongy Show. Oh my gosh, that's a tongue twister. And we're so thrilled that we were able to give like a little sneak peek clip of his amazing new music. Wasn't that awesome? All right, my lovely. So thus ends another episode of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, El Ariel, and we can be found on social media at Music Jobs Podcast. That's Music Jobs with an S Podcast. Or you can find me, your hostess with the mostest, El Ariel, at L-A-R-I-E-L Music. Or my website is lariel-music.com. That's lariel-music.com. Okay, my loves, stay warm wherever you are, unless you're in like the Southern Hemisphere. Remember to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you give up.